Welcome to the Commonweal Policy Podcast. It's me, Jonathan Chaffee. I'm the Campaigns Officer here at Commonweal, and I'm delighted to be joined for what is, I believe, our third episode focusing on the coronavirus and its various consequences with Dr. Craig Diehl. Craig, how are you getting on?
Hello, I am doing well. It's observing the nice weather from inside my house.
Yeah, I mean, I did manage to take a walk yesterday as part of my sort of half hour of exercise, and it was just interesting and quite liberating in a sense to be outside and not being rained on. So let's hope that we can move towards enjoying the outdoors at some stage, though that's not looking like it's going to be anytime soon, is it?
Not at all. The lockdowns have been extended for several weeks. There still are very few clear ideas of how to come out from lockdown, although it is interesting that both the UK and Scottish governments have been starting to maybe just dance around some of the topics that have been raised. Nicola Sturgeon, First Minister, has mentioned supporting the idea of the kind of test, trace and isolate strategy that Commonweal has advocated would be necessary to get out from these lockdown conditions. So we are going to hear a bit more from her later in this week, possibly about that strategy.
No, I mean, that's all very useful. And the subject matter of this podcast is going to be about one of the consequences of coronavirus that's really brought to the fore kind of underlying dynamics here around food, food production, access to food, and so on. But, you know, just before we get on to that, I was reading an article earlier today, and it was talking about a secondary lockdown after it being lifted for the first time. They're expecting to have to shut down again in the winter. And I mean, what's your assessment of that? Because I know you've done a lot of work in the testing, because to me this is important, because it kind of links to the conversation we're going to be having today, because it's about sustainability during these kinds of periods and more generally when it comes to access to things like food. Because, you know, you keep going back to lockdowns, surely that's going to have an impact on things like the food supply.
Yeah, not just on the political ramifications of telling everybody to go back indoors, but there's the ability to do so. I mean, people will get tired of these kind of regulations, and you might find that it becomes more difficult to get people to comply with regulations the second or the third time round. There are essentially two hypotheses at the moment of the current state of the pandemic. One is that essentially most people have already contracted it, and most of them had very mild symptoms or were asymptomatic. And if we unlock, then that herd immunity threshold may be quite close already. So that might be okay. But the other view is that the lockdown came in at a point before very many people contracted the virus at all. So either, you know, as you know, I've come through symptoms that were very much like COVID. I don't know if I actually had it because I haven't been tested, nor do I know if I've had it. Am I immune? But even if I am, I'm not treating it as if I am immune. But nobody out there has contracted the disease. Some estimates think maybe only 5% of us have got it so far. That means that 95% of us haven't contracted it and are definitely not immune. So if we unlock and the virus is still free, then we will get a secondary spike that could be as bad or even worse than the one we're going through at the moment.
Yeah, a story in the Washington Post saying it might even be worse. So, yeah, look, extremely difficult times ahead, but extremely difficult times now too. We wanted to really get into this question of food. I said, access to food, how it's produced, the sustainability of it. And we're going to cycle through a few different examples before we get to Scotland, because I want to get your take on this. I've been struck, as I'm sure you have, by some of the images that we've seen in America, where you've had huge tailbacks of cars filling up huge car parks and blocking motorways, I've seen in one picture, which form queues for food banks and food handouts. And this, of course, in in the richest and most powerful country in the world, in America. Something going badly wrong there, because it's not just a result of the virus, is it, that food insecurity has become a big issue internationally?
Yeah, especially in places like America. America is typified by having that very fast, very profitable economy, but no safety nets, no barriers, no regulations, nothing to fall back on. You don't have ubiquitous health care. You often don't have health insurance at all. You don't have a sweeping welfare state. Quite often, people who end up destitute do end up having to physically queue for food rather than receiving money to go and buy it. So you end up with being massive queues and a massively oversubscribed system that just cannot cope. And this is the real danger of these crises, is that the infrastructure to deal with them simply collapses, and you end up doing far, far more harm than from things that are going on outside of the virus itself than from the virus. You may find people, you know, dying through hunger or through other medical conditions, you know, whether they had a mild case of coronavirus or maybe didn't even contract it at all, but lost their job as a result of the lockdowns.
Yeah, and that's even before we get to the question of things like the quality of food that people are actually eating in quote-unquote normal times. Have you anything to say about that? Because this, of course, is an issue which affects really the whole of the world's population. You could move from the kind of food which Americans are consuming all the way through to the impact of genetically modified crops on parts of the global south, for example, where farming techniques have been undermined, and now farmers find themselves relying on rebuying GM stocks, for example. So there's lots going on here. What we're talking about really is international agribusiness and a sort of the attempt by free market globalization to distribute food, which has actually ended up creating famine at least three times in the last number of decades, where you have food exporting countries also finding that they can't feed their own people as a result of the way the system has been organized. So there's a lot of discussion about food sovereignty. I wondered what your kind of take on that was.
So food sovereignty, this is a concept that a country should be completely self-reliant, or have the ability to be self-reliant in food, not having to rely on imports for critical food, which on the surface of it makes sense. You know, if you're importing a keystone item of any nature, whether it's food or fuel or whatever, and those imports dry up because, for example, you have a global pandemic and now nobody's trading anything, you've seen a similar impacts happen in the oil industry this week, where oil price went to negative for reasons that my colleague Ben Ray pointed out in his daily newsletter. If you could have a diplomatic fight or a war with a country that you're importing from and your supply line dries up. So yeah, there is an attraction to that idea of food sovereignty, but there's also issues around capacity, around capability of doing that, and sustainability of doing that. One of the things that we're starting to face with the climate emergency is shifting zones of food production. So as the planet warms up, countries that are already quite hot are losing the ability to produce food. Their food yields per hectare are dropping. Those zones where food can be grown are starting to shift to higher latitudes. So you find that the global south, as a result of climate change, which has been most directly the caused by richer countries in the global north, are losing the ability to even achieve food sovereignty. Throw in the politics of food production moving from one country to another, but the politics of barriers going up and stopping people moving from one country to another, and then you could face a very, very severe long-term problem especially affecting places like the Global South?
So it's extremely complex. There's no easy answer to this. But I mean, my starting premise, I guess, is that the way we currently produce and consume food has to change. I think it has to change both for reasons of health and for reasons of ecology. I'm glad that you mentioned the climate change issue because, you know, I look at the coronavirus and the kind of consequences which come from it and think that in some ways it's a kind of snapshot of what serious climate breakdown might look like because of the way that it impacts the economic system. Climate breakdown is going to, in many cases, wipe out huge parts of the economic system as we know it. And one of the most important dangers that we have to analyse, and one of the most pressing matters we have to rise to, is the impact that it has on our food supply. As you've already outlined there, that will be a global question. It seems to me that on that basis, we have to start looking at some of the science behind how we might develop better, more ecological forms of food production, and marry that with a kind of political and social program, which means that, frankly, people aren't alienated from what they're eating and that they understand the importance of sustainable food and so on and so forth. So I wondered if you could just start to open up that issue from a scientific basis, because there's some quite interesting notes that I think would be worth our listeners hearing in relation to this.
Yeah, I mean, in many ways, the 20th century was a miracle in terms of food production. Over the course of the 20th century, and especially through the 1950s, 1960s, 1970s, you had the Green Revolution. We tripled the amount of food that we could grow in a given area. Folk like Norman Borlaug, who pioneered this stuff, has been credited with saving a billion lives from starvation.
That's incredible.
Yeah, and if you rack up, you know, if you use number of lives saved as a metric of, you know, greatest human ever, you know, these are the people who would be at the top of the list. But the kind of technology that went into that, the kind of industrialization of agriculture, the intensification of chemical fertilizers, the intensification of agriculture itself has had costs. You are seeing environmental degradation, you're seeing soil erosion, you're seeing habitat degradation, and you know, we're also seeing massive surpluses in food in certain countries, which has led to obesity, which has led to a diabetes epidemic. It's also worth noting in the current crisis, there is evidence that folk with diabetes are showing a vulnerability to this particular pandemic. So you can see how one health crisis can lead to another health crisis. And, you know, it's becoming clear that our agricultural practices cannot continue the way they're going. This is something that we explored in Commonweal in our common home plan, that as well as making sure everybody has enough food to eat now, we have to make sure that our ability to grow food is sustainable long into the future.
Absolutely. And the Common Home Plan, which we'll link to below this podcast, one of the things that particularly attracted me to it was its holistic approach to problems which are interconnected. It's very difficult to talk about any of these issues in isolation, as you've already very well described. There are overlapping health issues, for example, that we have to consider, and they are very connected to obviously our food consumption and our habits around food. Just before we get on to Scotland specifically, because I think there are some things we can draw from the Common Home Plan and from our discussions that we've been having in recent weeks around the virus. Mm. Before we get to that, some of the things that I've been reading around food and how it's being impacted by the virus are really quite, it's not just that they're kind of eye-opening because we already knew about the problems that existed around food, but there are serious political and social consequences that come from an inadequate food supply. You know, this is where not only is there a breakdown in relation to, you know, how are people getting food, but if a government or if a society or a system is unable to provide for people food, then that is a very basic necessity. And if that's not being delivered, then clearly there are going to be very profound, even historic, implications socially and politically. And this is something that we've seen actually, as I use the word historic there, this is something that we've seen throughout history.
Yeah.
You have any comment on that?
I mean, the quote varies in its detail, but you do see the famous line that civilization is only like 9 meals from revolution.
Yes, exactly.
You know, if food supply fails, people don't have a lot of time to hang around and wait for it to come back online again before, you know, they are starving. And again, even on a sort of economic level, you're seeing impacts of the virus on food supplies, even again in relatively rich countries like the UK, where you're starting to see footage of you know, milk being poured down the drain because it can't be sold, because, you know, the people aren't going out to restaurants or the places where that milk would normally be sold to have shut down, and they haven't been able to redirect the supply chain elsewhere.
Well, that's,
so it's a really paradoxical situation where you can be looking at a society with empty supermarket shelves and people struggling to buy food, but on the same day in the same place, food is rotting in a field for lack of labour to pick it. Food is rotting in a warehouse for lack of means to distribute it. This is what it means for the entire system to start breaking down.
Exactly, and that also shows the complete folly that the market can unfettered deliver and distribute food on anywhere like a rational basis. That's just obviously now not the case, and it's been obvious to people for many years, but I think it's now going to come to widespread public attention, and therefore openings emerge.
Yeah, it's again a bit like that lack of safety net thing you see in America. The market provides a very efficient mechanism in normal times when the environment doesn't change, but when the environment changes, there's no buffer, there's no safety net, and the system breaks. So this is why, you know, Commonweal's next big project is going to be looking at how do we rebuild the economy coming out of this pandemic, but rebuilding it from a foundational economics approach, looking at what we need to produce first, and then looking at it from a resilient economics approach. How can we build the system so that it can withstand shocks better than the system that we had before this pandemic could? Because once we come out of the pandemic, we have other shocks coming on the horizon, most notably the climate emergency.
Exactly. And probably worth even saying that even when there is no environmental or virus-related issues, the process of globalisation, corporate globalisation in particular, has led to all kinds of disparities when it comes to access and so on in relation to food, as you've outlined at the start of this podcast. So clearly things have to change, and let's move on to some of the changes that we might make. You've alluded there to the next big bit of work. I mean, I say big bit of work. This is going to be probably the most substantial thing that we've produced, given the scale of the challenge of rebuilding in the aftermath of the virus. But focusing on food, and now let's turn to Scotland in particular. Lots of people say, well, maybe Scotland could start looking towards its own programme for food sovereignty. Now, look, I agree with that, but there are some important complications and challenges that we would have to discuss. And so let's do that. What do you see as being the main benefits, but also the main challenges to building a Scotland which is food sovereign?
Well, the benefit obviously is that you're not reliant on a Keystone import, and in troubling and uncertain times, that can give you a foundation that you can rely on. One prominent downside is that we can over-focus on Scotland's self-sufficiency to the point of forgetting the rest of the world is important too. You know, if we abandon the global south to the ravages of climate change, build a wall, create a little arcology, and everybody inside that wall is fine, and we don't need to worry about everyone outside, then we're not really doing our best by humanity or best by the planet.
Yeah.
The other challenge is that, yeah, I mean, Scotland's often talked about as if, and the claims often made that Scotland is a net exporter of food, or Scotland grows more calories worth of food than it uses. And those two things are true, but the shape of our food production and our food exports is needs to be considered as well. You know, right now, Scotland grows enough barley to feed everybody in Scotland. But we don't eat a lot of barley. I quite like a barley risotto and a Scotch broth, but we don't eat that much barley. Most of our barley goes to the whiskey industry. A good chunk goes to animal feed.
So, exactly, yeah.
So, yeah, just looking at the overall headline of calories produced doesn't really tell you about the shape of the production within the country. So you have to start looking at that shape. You know, there will be a question at some point. Does Scotland need to produce as much whiskey as it does? If we start looking at a more foundational approach, that's maybe a difficult question to ask and a harder one to answer, especially as I glance over at my own whiskey cabinet. but we also then start looking at the sustainability side. Is Scotland growing food in a way that is sustainable? Right now, probably not. We need to move to a more agroecology model of food production. And in our common home and the common home plan, we talk about what that would look like.
So I think it is important at this point that we point out to listeners that, you know, we're not going to be advocating that people live on the basis of calories gained from barley. I mean, I think that will be a very difficult sell. But one of the things that the common
home plan... Just wait till you try my barley risotto.
I'm sure it's lovely, but there's also other ingredients in there, you know. But this is one of the things that I found probably not just that it's interesting, but I think it could be quite liberating for people as well. I think we live in an alienated society. You know, we're alienated from our how we produce, alienated from each other a lot of the time.
Yeah.
And having some hand in actually producing food and understanding where our food comes from, in enjoying locally produced food stuff. This to me is something which we should be thinking of in very positive terms, that actually the quality, the taste, the health benefits that we could get from sustainable locally grown food is something to be celebrated rather than feared, and certainly something to be I think not just looked at, but we should put this into practice. Now the question that I've got on that basis then is one of scale. Okay, so I know lots of people who organize community gardens, for example, or people who have set up allotments. And there are some even larger schemes which might hope to band together a street, for example, and on bringing up some crops and some vegetables which they use. But when I talk about scale, I'm wanting to ask you, how is it that we could extend this to something which is genuinely a nationwide phenomenon?
Yeah, I mean, I am one of the very, very lucky ones who has a substantial garden on my property, and we have started growing a few fruits and vegetables, so be interesting to see how they develop over the next season. Just got my garlics in last week. They're looking
good. I mean, I'm sure they'll be amazing.
But yeah, I do want to see a more decentralized food supply network. I want to see more of the food grown locally going into our local schools. I'm not necessarily advocating that every single person becomes food sovereign in that way. But there is clearly ways we can improve it. And of course, it is much harder if you do live in a city, or you do live in a flat, you don't have a garden, you don't have space to grow things. We might have to start looking at how do we shorten supply chains for food within cities, and that could mean more urban farming, taking over derelict spaces within cities and building spaces where food can be grown. I love just sort of wandering around the centre of Glasgow. I mean, obviously can't do it now, but used to love wandering through the centre of Glasgow and pointing at the various spaces in the centre of the city and just thinking, you know, how many raised beds could you put in there? How many polytunnels could you put in there? Taking that a step further, we now have the ability to start growing a lot more food indoors under artificial light. So we could potentially start seeing a more technological approach to bringing food into the cities, where we start building warehouses or even taking over old blocks of flats and converting them into you know, very technological spaces to grow food.
This excites me a lot, because your conversation starts with, we need accessible and healthy food that's reliable and not reliant on global supply chains, and very quickly turns into a conversation about, well, we need more green spaces in our cities. We need more collective understanding of how food is produced, which gives us more power, which gives us more of a sense of our place in the world, which brings communities together potentially. So the kind of social and geographical benefits that come from having a really serious approach to food seem to me to be immense.
I mean, there's nothing that unites humanity more than food. It goes deep into our history. There's nothing more social than literally breaking a loaf of bread with someone. It's embedded in a great many cultures around the world, and it shouldn't be forgotten, shouldn't be underestimated. And I think that some of us maybe have started to do that.
You know what, actually, I think let's hear from people who are tuning into this. You know, have you been involved in any of this, even at a very small level? We want to hear from you. You know, get in touch and let us know your thoughts on this, your experience of growing food, or in fact, if you have any wider knowledge about food systems that you can feed into our policy production. There's one other question I wanted to ask before we bring this to a conclusion. I wanted to ask you about the use of technology in helping us to grow foods which wouldn't normally grow in the Scottish climate. Because I believe there are things that you can do that would allow us to achieve some of those things. Any suggestions on how we might do that?
I mean, one of the jokes I've sometimes made when talking about food in the Common Home Plan is that we can grow quite a lot in Scotland, but one thing we can't grow is coffee. And I consider that, if not vital to my existence, at least quite important. More seriously, I mean, this idea of you know, maybe growing more food indoors allows you to more carefully control climate, which could be vital in if we allow the climate to continue breaking down. It's not just sort of crops that you can't grow in outside Scotland. It can't grow inside Scotland. It's also about the crops that we currently do grow inside Scotland. What happens if we, you know, allow our cropland to start flooding or storms to start ravaging our fields? That's what will happen if we allow climate change to keep going. So it's a difficult question. I know we're getting a bit onwards in time. It's maybe something we can come back to in another episode. But I'm not advocating a single solution to this. I'd much rather avoid that particular dystopian future than have to try and cope with it. I do definitely see the role of technology. I see the role for developing new strains of crops that are more weather resistant, more heat resistant, more cold resistant. The lessons that we learn from the Green Revolution, we can take forward into a new Green Revolution that can continue to feed everyone on the planet, can fix a lot of the wrongs that have been perpetuated by the issues that you've brought up in our chat today, and can also help to heal the planet as well.
Well, that seems to me an excellent place to bring the podcast to a close. You know, just to reiterate, I think that you know, I completely agree that there's not going to be one easy solution to this. There's going to have to be a range of approaches that help us to deal with how we rebuild in the aftermath of the coronavirus, and how we do so on a basis that puts people and planet before the bankers and the corporations who have had it their way for too long, and who have in many ways got us into the situation that we are in today. And this, I think, will be an international phenomenon, and Scotland will have to play its role. So the role of Commonweal within that is to help to provide in Scotland there being a policy platform that can really begin to get to grips with the big issues of our time. And we are working extremely hard on both a policy paper about how we're going to rebuild from the aftermath of the coronavirus and of the economic destruction that will have taken place, and also about how we're going to launch a really serious campaign of activism to make sure that it's Commonweal and the ideas that Commonweal has been putting out for many years now, which come to bring about some economic justice for the people of Scotland and I believe beyond, if we can set a good example. We'll see you again next week. I know there's been a couple of little noises on this call. It's quite interesting, Craig, isn't it, having to record these in separate parts of the country, and with doing our best with the technology, but I think it's working pretty well. Yeah. And you know, we hope that listeners are still managing to enjoy our kind of overview of what we are doing at Commonweal and of some of the big issues of our time.
Yeah, I hope so. I hope folk are still listening in. And yeah, just to reiterate what Jonathan said a wee bit earlier, send in your ideas, send in some of your inspiring stories of your interactions with food through this lockdown, and send in some recipes if you have some. That could be an interesting thing to share.
Definitely. On that note, folks, I hope you get through the next week okay. Look after each other and stay safe, and we'll be back next week with more on the coronavirus and how Commonweal is going to confront both the virus and the consequences that come from it.